Welcome to Make Matriarchy Great Again. Hello and welcome to the 34 Circe Salon, Make Matriarchy Great Again. This is Lauren Torres and I'm here with
Dawn Sam Alden. Welcome, welcome everyone.
Pretty excited to be here. We could go the light applause.
There you go. Fabulous. Lauren is learning how to use the sound effect.
Podcast host.
Fabulous. I love it.
Yeah. And we have an amazing guest today. Yeah, we're starting a new series, the Founding Mother series, and today we're going to talk about the founding mother of improv. Most people don't realize that the person who really began improv in the United States, really internationally, was a woman, Viola Spolin. And today we are very happy to welcome her granddaughter, Aretha Sills, who is a very expert. She's just full of historical knowledge about Viola Spolin. She was recently featured on the PBS documentary Inventing Improv, which you can find online. And she did a wonderful job talking about Viola there. And we're extremely excited to welcome her today. So welcome, Aretha. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for the warm welcome.
Yes. So if you wanted to tell a little bit about yourself before you started, you have a lot of experience teaching Viola's work, however you feel, whatever you'd like to say there.
Sure. Well, I met Viola first as my grandmother. My dad was Paul Sills, and he was my teacher of Viola's work, his mother's work, to which he was dedicated his whole life long. He was the founding director of some of the first improvisational theater companies in Chicago, including the Compass Players and the Second City. And he created Story Theater, which was might be of interest to followers of this podcast because it's about traditional stories from the oral tradition. And he was a very well-known and important director in his day, and he still is, but all he as he would always say, honor thy mother. His contributions to the theater came out of being trained in his mother's work, and his mother was Viola Spolin, who's known as the mother of improvisational theater and the originator of theater games. And so I teach her work as taught to me by Paul Sills. And I teach online in intensives in New York and Chicago and LA and wherever people want to bring me in. And I also adapt her games for writers.
And you're a wonderful teacher, as I can say from experience.
Always wonderful to work with you, Lauren. Yeah, Lauren came to Door County, Wisconsin, where I live, to do a week-long intensive and did the teacher training online.
Oh, yeah, fabulous.
I knew I wanted to learn improv because everybody hears improv and they think comedy.
Right.
And once I saw the documentary, I could see that improv's really about being in the moment, improvising, being fully present, being embodied. It's really not about trying to get to the joke. And I thought, I don't want to take an improv class. I want to take Viola Spolin's work because to me that not only does it get back to the roots of what she was teaching, but it seems to really teach liberation and
communication.
Right. It's a very powerful work. And you could see that Viola was interested in the theater from the beginning. I mean, it sounds like she sort of popped out of the womb interested in the theater. She's in Chicago with the Russian Jewish immigrants, big diverse group. And she started really being doing things with the theater almost immediately, from what I can tell.
Yeah, she was born in Chicago. Her parents were pretty recent Russian Jewish immigrants. So she was, you know, a neighborhood kid. Her parents were busy and working, but somehow she had this, she was putting on plays and rounding up, you know, her family members, her brothers and sisters and the neighborhood kids to put on shows. And she was looking for theater training in any way she could get it. And yeah, so she, but there was also this family tradition of play from her that came from her parents and her aunts and uncles and cousins, where they would all get together and play games after work. And a lot of charades type games, and then sing songs around the piano and improvise stories based on their family history, like operas in the form of operas or, you know, whatever the case may be. That, you know, before TV, people had to entertain themselves, and they really, really did.
Right.
And then she also like played with the kids on the in the street. So she was interested in the theater, and she was interested in play right out of the gate.
Right.
Yeah. There's that wonderful quote from the documentary: "The games she created are about the space between people." I thought that was really wonderful.
And well, we haven't even got there yet, but that's true,
right? Yeah. And I think that part where then she met Neva Boyd, that part where Neva Boyd was basically a social worker helping a diverse group of children and researching games and how games are used to democratize group interaction, how they're used to build communities. So that was kind of the second growth stage, I believe, when she started working with Neva at the Hull House in Chicago, which was a central learning hub for that community. Could you tell us a little bit about that interaction, that understanding Neva Boyd's work on games and how that fed into her work?
Yeah. Well, after high school, two of Viola's sisters took her to go work with Neva Boyd, who was training young people in group work, which we would now call social work. So she was training people to go into the community and work with groups. And she was a resident of Hull House, which was a famous settlement house in Chicago founded by Ellen Gates Starr and Jane Addams. So it was like the hub of the progressive era philosophies in the United States. And the, you know, we could go down a deep rabbit hole there. It's very, very interesting.
But also very, very much a sort of woman rich movement at the Hull House.
Absolutely. It was, it was founded by two women, and many of the residents were women. I would probably say most, but not all. So it was a safe space for gay and lesbian residents of Chicago at the time. And it was a place where unmarried women could go. If you follow my meaning, and be safe from the traditional bounds of marriage, where they would not be able to express themselves fully. And the idea was that there were all these immigrants coming into Chicago from everywhere around the world at that time. It was founded in 1890. Jane Addams had seen a settlement house in London, and she was sort of a wealthy Christian woman who was very wanted to do good. She saw the settlement house and how much good it was doing for the poor people in London, and she wanted to do something similar in Chicago. So she rented this mansion, Hull House, that had been abandoned by its previous owner, because that neighborhood had become where all, you know, the like an intersection of a bunch of different immigrant neighborhoods. So, you know, the rich people hightailed it out of there.
Right.
Well, they called it a ghetto, right? You know, so, and if you go to Hull House now, it's still standing as a museum. But you can see Greek Town's right there, the Little Italy of Chicago. Maxwell Street.
Chinatown's not that far away.
Right. Yeah. So, and at the time, so there were immigrants like Viola, Russian Jews. There were Irish immigrants, Russian, Italian, Greek, Syrian. And by the time Viola, maybe a little after Viola's people, well, several decades after Viola's people would have immigrated to Chicago, the Black diaspora from the South, and that became also a Black neighborhood. So Hull House, Maxwell Street, and all that amazing history in Chicago there of the blues and just the, you know, so.
All right there, that nexus.
It's like right there. Yeah. And so Viola was so lucky to be there. But so everyone, every, they were putting on, the central idea was that to integrate the immigrants who are coming in from everywhere into American culture and into the idea of democracy, that education was needed and everyone deserved access to education and the arts. And so there was this great, they had and social services as well. So Hull House did all of those things. And it's, yeah, there's a whole other podcast episode on Hull House for your purposes.
There's many different languages. Now, the thing that's intriguing about to me is that I think either Viola or Neva both zeroed in on this ability for games to equalize the interaction between diverse groups of people. You didn't have to have a hierarchy. You didn't have to have people pointing out this is what you do. There's this self-organizing aspect to like a diverse amount of games. Neva collected games from around the world. So it wasn't like a board game. It was all sorts of games. But once you put people in the space of the game, somehow it's self-organized. And so I wanted you to talk a little bit about that equalization, that democratization, or the power that comes out of that. Because I don't think everyone understands that. What were you going to say, Dawn?
And we're talking about physical games.
Right.
Well, the kind of games that need that. So back to the history a little bit. So Viola went to study with Neva Boyd, and she worked with her for 3 years, learning to be a social worker by learning games to take into the community, because that was Neva Boyd's great belief that play was a liberatory force and a healing force, and was of great use in social work and education. Because, I mean, the progressive era, there were also all sorts of believers in experiential education were part of that movement. And so this was another part of that. But the other thing that, you know, we learn through play, we learn through experience, and we learn in our own way. And it's not that top down model of education that comes from the authority downward. It's just an opening up of the person. And then they have the chance to go beyond what the teacher knows and the culture knows and the authority knows. And so it's an explosion of everything can happen. And so that was, you know, Neva Boyd was a great believer in experiential education and play. And her papers are really interesting to read. So Viola was just inundated with all this rich, wonderful philosophy through Neva Boyd, but also experience in just how play, everything you need can happen through play. And Neva Boyd actually argued that the way play operates, it helps, like it gets to what Jane Addams wanted, which was everyone to participate in a democracy. Jane Addams said you need to have social ethics. She has this great text called Democracy and Social Ethics. It was one of her big books. And Neva, and it was the idea that you need to get out, you need to meet people who are not like you and get out of your own sphere of influence, whatever that might be. It might be economic or your political party or your ethnic makeup or whatever. You had to meet people who are not like you and get to know their needs and concerns and carry that with you. And, you know, we all work together to help each other out. She said, we almost walk the common road and get to know the size of one another's burdens. Right. Mm-hmm. And Neva Boyd said that play develops social values. So, because when you're playing, you got a game on and you will watch a bunch of kids, there's a lot of disagreements that happen. When you're getting a game up, right? No, those aren't the rules. Yeah, those are the rules. I want to do this. I want to do this. This is my part. That's your part. And the child has to negotiate, and the adult has to negotiate those rules. And they will, because in most cases, they will negotiate all that difficulty to get the game up and running to keep the play happening. And it's its own reward.
Yeah.
So it's not, it's an internal intrinsic reward. She's play is happifying. It makes us happy to play. There's like a universal human need to play. And, and so through that, it's also, again, that's kind of, you know, anti-authoritarian in a way. You're not doing it as it's the right thing to do. You're doing it because you want to, and that's why it works so well. So she argued that play teaches children social ethics because you're navigating and negotiating all these different needs.
Yes.
And so
you don't have to have someone involved. You just can step in once in a while, but the children really do a lot of the organization because you have an objective. Yeah. We're building snowboards, or we're doing a type of tag game, or we're pretending to throw a ball around, or whatever it is. It's giving us an objective to organize ourselves around. And that's about that and not about disagreements or. Yeah.
And as Viola asks, well, you know, why do we agree to the rules of a game, right? Why do we all agree to the rules of the game? Because it's more fun that way. I mean, ask any group of kids and they'll be like, well, otherwise, you know, they give you these great answers. And so she was, you know, Neva Boyd in her papers, she really wrote about how play can be used to like, for example, with children, they called them delinquent back in the day. That was the, you know, the vintage language. We would now say traumatized or, you know, exhibiting antisocial behavior, basically. So she's working with kids like that. And what her philosophy was, just get them involved in playing games where they will be, they can use their best nature. And suddenly there it is. There's their best nature. And they develop self-confidence in their own, you know, ability to be successful in life through play, because in those imagined spaces of play, or those, like, you know, those liminal spaces that aren't quite real life, but there are real experiences, right?
Exactly.
And so those are, we can do the right thing when we play without knowing how, and it's healing. And so Viola learned so much from Neva Boyd. She actually, you know, said the effects of her inspiration never left me for a single day.
Right. And then she, after she had her children, she really began to be able to focus on theater.
Right.
And it seems like that's when those two worlds began to be integrated more. And I know there's two parts that were especially interesting. One was her returning to Hull House to teach, but also there's that period of time where she was divorced, living with other divorced women. I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's sort of jumping ahead a little bit in how Viola developed theater games. But which one do you want first?
We have Neva, and then is there a piece in the middle I was missing there that you want to speak to
Viola married her first husband, Wilmer, right after working with Neva Boyd. She was pretty young. And then she had her two boys, Paul and Bill. She couldn't work for a time there because she had these two really young boys, like back to back. And so she would have her girlfriends over to her apartment and they would play games, which is kind of, for the purposes of your podcast, sort of an interesting story, too. That she told the historian Jeff Sweet that she would have her girlfriends over to play games, and she would prop Paul, the baby, up on the bed. And she said to watch, because, you know, no babysitters. Who can afford babysitters?
Right. So, it's the depression, basically, right?
right. And she said that was the roots of Second City. She thought Paul watching these hilarious women play games propped up on the bed, you know. But eventually she was able to work again, and she also started getting like real serious theater training in any way she could. She was a single mom, and she got divorced really quickly after having her two kids too. She was incredibly modern and forward thinking, which which is off, you know, is sometimes the case with a first generation American, because the old country is a lot of trauma and, you know, they're looking toward the new. Viola was a real example of that, or maybe that's specific to the women of the 30s. Her generation were incredibly modern.
Okay, yeah.
Incredibly forward thinking. They were ready to cast off a lot of old rules, right? And if you look at pictures of Viola and her friends, they all had bobbed hair and red lipstick and they wore men's clothes and they were like, you know, they were fun.
Yeah. They were,
so Viola, so she started getting theater training, traditional theater training. And plus in that time, there were a lot of Russian emigres. And so they were bringing Stanislavski and method acting training there. So she was doing a lot of that. And night school, she trained at DePaul and she was doing whatever she could as a divorced mom. And right. One of the things that you mentioned that's so cool is that she and a whole bunch of other divorced women during the Depression rented a house on Lakeshore Drive because, again, the people had lost all their money. So then there were these like, so the mansion was actually right next door to Oscar Meyer's mansion. My dad used to tell us about how watching Oscar Meyer walk down the steps every morning.
Oh, wow.
Fascinated with this figure. Like, you know, he was a big man and he had a like a stovepipe hat and he described it so vividly. But it was this mansion on Lakeshore Drive, which is, you know, beautiful view of the lake and all these.
It's a very expensive place to live, generally speaking.
A whole bunch of divorced and single moms pooled their money to rent this mansion and they hired a cook. And people to watch they would all watch their children, so they could live communally and make sure their children were safe and taken care of. And, they could work. And it was, and of course, Viola being Viola, she gave it a name. She called it the educational playroom and she had stationery made, which is really cute. And cause that was Viola. She was that type of organizer and a philosopher of like communal life and you know, I talked to my dad would talk about it. And I met a guy about 10 years ago now who had been raised with Paul there for the couple of years that happened. And the great, they had such amazing memories of that time and they loved it so much. Just living together with a whole bunch of kids, you know, what fun.
Right.
And then my dad also said that, the lifeguards would all come hang out, like with all the, you know, young moms and they had all the lifeguards were always over there. And
it's members not far of from the lake where the lifeguards at the lake and then they'd come over.
They'd come over after work or whatever.
That's what Lakeshore Drive means for those who haven't lived in Chicago. it's near the lake.
Across the street.
Exactly.
And also the members of the group theater would come by because Viola had gone to New York to learn from the group theater. And she met John Garfield there and other. So people like it was just a hub of the coolest people in the 30s were hanging out there. And the group theater was also started by Harold Klerman and the Adlers and all, you know, these amazing theater people. But it was like they were proponents of the method acting movement in the United States via Stanislavski's teachings. But they were also they had a real communist and socialist philosophy and bent to their thinking.
Should we, Dawn, do you think we need to explain method acting for the listener? I don't know. It's just a particular style, right?
Yeah, I think it's sort of as you were saying, an American developed style that came out of the Russian Stanislavski teachings. And it's a much more naturalistic style, that kind of thing. I think people are,
people are.
They can Google it.
Google it. Marlon Brando and
it is different than improv, which is what we will be talking about. It is a different style than improv.
Yes, of course.
It is of interest though to Viola's work because what she ended up developing as she got into creating theater games was sort of an answer to the method in a lot of ways.
Fascinating.
Even though a lot of the goals are similar, the ways are different. And so it was important that she had that training with Stanislavski-based theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where are we at next? So is that her start? Did she start with the WPA after that?
Yeah. Or was there... After that. Right.
Yeah.
So she, you know, Neva Boyd got her. So when the WPA came around, it was the Works Project Administration. They were trying to get the country back to work after the Depression. And the government was actually paying artists to make murals and put on classes.
Can
you imagine?
That must be wonderful.
I can't, but it happened, people. And so did the progressive movement in the United States. And that's why it's important to me to talk about that with my students, because people have no idea. There was a huge political and intellectual progressive movement in the United States that actually like changed the laws of this country to be more helpful to women and to working people and to children and on and on and on. That you know, public education came out of, and public parks and all these things. Yeah, we as a country, we need to know this and take stock of it, because it's
because Chicago has a lot of parks. There's a park in every neighborhood.
Right. Yes.
And I watched a different documentary where, because Chicago did that, people had a place to go take a shower if they were living in a more of a ghetto. And they had a place to go get education so they could better their lives. And they had a place to go be outside if they were in cramped housing. So that there was a lot of that. You can find parks all over Chicago because of that.
And that came out of Hull House and the political activism, the social activism that was happening there.
Viola's hooked into that. She's part of this movement.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, the whole Neva Boyd was part of that recreation. Her school was called the Recreational Training School. She was training recreation workers to go into the park system or what have you to work as social workers. Group workers, they called it at the time, but Neva Boyd was a sociologist, and she actually founded the School of Sociology at Northwestern. She's a real founding mother in a lot of ways, you know, especially
indeed.
her, you know, in the training of social workers, she's so important. And then in the development of improvisational theater, she's an unheralded woman who everyone needs to read her and.
Yeah, I mean, we really have more than one founding mother in this episode.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That they're so contemporary, these women too, that it's important for us to go back and understand their philosophies now, because they were kind of cast out of the conversation in the later part of the 20th century, and to the detriment of the art form, you know, and now people are coming back and understanding that, you know, there's that whole applied improv movement. Guess where it started, folks? Applying it in the community.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. So Viola started working in the community through the WPA. She got hired and she was making like $35 a week or something for the first time. There's a story of her running around going, "I'm rich." You know?
That's all actors do at some point. You get a job and you feel rich for a while, right?
She was, you know, there was always kind of hand to mouth being a teaching artist.
Yes.
Yes.
That part hasn't changed.
Yes.
So she was working in the community. She was going in and finding, they would send her to work with groups, like, and she would work wherever, with orphanages, with church groups. She was working with immigrant adults and kids. And, you know, she wrote in her resume, working girls. I'm assuming that meaning sex workers. I mean, literally working everywhere she would, everywhere, any group at all, and playing games with them, right? But she would, because she was so interested in the theater, she was teaching them dramatics and she was putting on shows. And she found that the training that she had from, you know, wasn't helpful with what she called everyday people. She called her students everyday people, people just like her. They didn't need lectures on blocking and projection.
Right.
None of that. What does that language even mean? She would have to stop everything and explain it to them. And then meanwhile, all this other, you know, kids are running around over here, you know, so she realized that her work with Neva Boyd would be helpful in all these areas. And so every time she had something to explain about communicating in the theater to her groups, she created a game. And the focus of the game imparted something they needed to know about communicating in the theater. And they learned it their own way through experience, through play, right?
Right. Did she call them play games at this point? I know she used to call them problems.
Yeah.
She was trying to solve problems. When was this, would she have been calling them problems at this time? She was trying to just solve a different problem. So
yeah.
Then she gave the group a problem to solve, like
yeah.
how to contact with each other or
right.
how to, like she invented gibberish at this time, maybe because she had people speaking different languages.
She didn't invent gibberish, actually. Okay. That there's it came from the group theater, but she used gibberish and she would create theater games with gibberish. I mean, I think uh-huh. gibberish goes back as far as humans have. I mean, babies and, you know, I mean, I think people have always played around with it. But the group theater definitely used gibberish to further whole body communication. And
that's where people speak just meaningless languages. And then there's that there's an interpretation process.
Yeah.
Momentary pause while the phone rings. No worries.
Yeah.
It's nonsense syllables shaped like language. And so you get beyond issues of language.
So she's solving different problems by using games, and people are coming to understand for themselves that she doesn't say this is what you do. They begin to realize, oh, this is how I solve whatever this problem is, to cross the stage, to project
yeah.
more, to interact differently, to not block the student that's behind me. We did that game in your class, you know, make sure everybody's always visible.
Oh, stage picture. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, to be aware of where you are in stage space at every moment. Yeah, these are really complicated. The theater problems are complex problems, right?
Yes.
And so, yes, you could sit there and tell everyone how to do it, but then you would just get one terrible thing with no life in it, right?
Right.
Right.
So Viola knew that a game brought out all the spontaneity and energy and kept the life force of the person intact, which is, I mean, what do we want from our actors? That's it, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so the focus of the game, the rules of a game, and her games always have a focus that you return to again and again that occupies the mind and allows you to sort of get past the grip of the past. The mind is always trying to trip us up from achieving yeah. presentness, right? So her games always involve a focus which helps us get us out of the head and into the space. And she called improvising like, there's a wonderful quote of hers where improvising is openness to the contact with the environment and each other and a willingness to play and entering into the experience, right, with your sensory equipment. So all of her games allow people to do that, but in their own way. She said there's no right or wrong way to solve a problem. There's only the seeking, which is one of the biggest challenges of being a side coach of this work, is that people always want to find the right or wrong way to solve a problem.
Right.
And the side coach is never allowed to, that's not what the side coach does. They don't decide this is good or bad. The individual has to do that for themselves. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Again, maintaining this sort of egalitarian nature of the play. Yeah.
Yeah, the first words of her book are everyone can act, everyone can improvise. And her book being that she published eventually with working on these methods over many, many years. In 1963, she published Improvisation for the Theater, which was the first improvisational theater text and still widely in use. And it's now in its third edition. But
it's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
The introduction is wonderful. Even if you're not acting, there's just so many insights. It's just a lot of insights.
She says everyone can act. Everyone can improvise. Anyone who wishes to can play in the theater and learn to become stage worthy. And then she talks about how, you know, talent has little to do with it, and that what is necessary is to open up our capacity for experiencing. And so then what comes next is sort of, she calls it like a charted course in doing that. And so this is a whole teaching method based on play, and which is a synonym to experience in viola language. You can't have an authoritarian model of critique. You're going to shut it all down, right?
Right.
Just like that. And no one will ever get past what the teacher knows. So it's a whole, the evaluation method, the way the workshops is held, everything about it was carefully considered to be a non-authoritarian and also non-verbal system of theater mm-hmm. training.
Yeah. And so she's developing that in Chicago. Then she takes it to LA and continues first to San Francisco, I believe, and then to LA, and she's teaching children. And that's about the time her son sort of ventures back to Chicago, kind of bringing forth what he learned and starting the roots of improv in Chicago.
Performing type of
right.
animal. Right. Yeah.
Major, major people studying with Viola or learning from her methods, like Alan Alda and people like that, as the work progresses. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Viola, she'd been married to a guy named Ed Spolin at that point, who was, and he went to war, Second World War. And she went to Oakland she worked in the shipyards there, like a Rosie the Riveter.
Right.
And then they moved down to LA, where she had friends from Chicago, and she bought a hillside and built this hand-built hippie home when her husband came back, and started a theater there. And she just kept developing her game. She kept, every time she had something she needed to tell an actor, she'd go, wait, that's a game, and make it a game instead. So, and then Paul was in high school, my dad, and mm-hmm. He went to this great progressive school called Francis Parker that he loved. Someone had gotten him, actually some kids who had seen Viola's theater troupe performing, and Paul was in it. That's how early Paul was born in this work. He was just right. baby on the bed in all those groups performing, and they got him a scholarship. They're like, to Francis Parker, because it was
that in Chicago.
Yeah, it's still there. And Francis Parker was a great progressive educator. And this was this kind of school where everyone could be on the football team and in the play. And my dad loved it so much. He did it all. And he couldn't stand California because he missed his buddies. He missed Francis Parker. He was gone. He was sent from this amazing, nurturing school where he could do whatever he wanted. He was the quarterback on the football team. He was directing the plays. And he would describe like the costume shops at this place, because all the rich people, they'd get all the cast offs from like the Gilded Age. And that was the costume shop. And so he was going to schools with 1,200 kids or something. He was like, get me out of here. So he hitchhiked his way back to Chicago and just stayed with friends and finished out his time at Francis Parker. And and then he went to University of Chicago, which had no theater department. But it had this amazing progressive, I guess the president, what do you call the
dean?
Was Robert Hutchins. And it was this other progressive hotbed of learning that attracted all these amazing people like Elaine May and Mike Nichols, he met there, and Severin Darden, and all these wonderful, people. And so they started theaters, and the Pivens, and you know, on and on, a lot of the loop theater movement, the small theater movement and stuff came out of the work they were doing there. Playwrights Theater Club and Compass Players came out of the, and Ed Asner was there, Alan Arkin later in Second City. Amazing, wonderful people to just go to college with and be able to start a theater with, right? I mean, it was incredible. So later he brought Viola in. They had started Playwrights Theater Club, which was
call it a predecessor of Second City, for people who know what Second City is. It's not the same, but each step took him
Yeah, and this was like the predecessor to the predecessor to Second City.
Yes, exactly.
It was a repertory theater company where they were putting on Brecht and Shakespeare and what have you, Ibsen, and like a show a week. They had some crazy schedule when they all lived, again, communally. Yeah. And when you see any interview with Paul from that period, this is like the early mid-50s, he talks about community. That the theater is a search for a community is his real philosophy that came from his mother, right? And he was bringing her methods to the work that he was doing. So and then they literally brought her back in. He and the producer David Shepherd brought her back to direct a show at Playwrights, and she came back to Chicago for a time there. And then, from there he founded the Compass.
Director
of the Compass Players. David Shepherd was the producer, and then Second City. After that, he was
And you would think everyone knows Second City, but I found that people don't. Right, so for the people who don't know what Second City is, it's an improv theater in Chicago. But a lot of people who end up being famous on Saturday Night Live. start at Second City. So it's the place where if you look at some of the pictures, it's like a who's who of major comedians or major actors like Alan Arkin, that they were part of this group. And it's founded in Viola's methods. I think she came back to Second City to teach at some point as well. If I remember correctly.
I don't know if she was there right at the founding, but they brought her in to be the director of workshop. And she was working with the company there, but she was also teaching workshops to the neighborhood kids and the community and everyone, you know, and people of all ages would come and they would do workshops with her, and it was all her methods. And then her theater games. And that's when she really got down to work writing improvisation for the theater, kind of after she saw the methods in action with the professional company, sort of took it at Second City, took it to another level. And she wrote a lot of it in the Lincoln Hotel in Chicago, or all of it, where she lived. And then she'd walk over to Second City. And a lot
of people don't realize, I said this at the beginning, but the objective wasn't to be funny. That was a side effect of that authentic storytelling. When you're being really real, the things that happen are funny, you know, it wasn't like we're trying to get the joke. We're trying to get the real story. We're trying to get an authentic story that comes from a real authentic place. And one of the things that really impressed me about Viola's book was there's this whole section where she talks about not being dominated, basically about how other people start to think for you. You start to look for approval.
Yeah.
In looking for approval and looking for disapproval, just prevents you from ever really being authentic and living from your real lived experience, not the past, you know, not, I'm not living in a past, I'm living in a present moment, and everything comes out of that moment.
Yeah.
And then you hear someone like Alan Alda or Alan Arkin or Paul Sands talk, and you hear them say, this is where they learned how to act. It gave them something different than the method acting did, because I think Alan Alda said something about it really puts you in a state of empathy in relationship with your other people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things that people forget about Viola's method is that it was for the theater. It was a complete form of actor training. And improvisational theater that emerged out of it, comedy, is a sort of byproduct. I mean, spontaneity is, it just brings forth laughter and a comedy and a joyful response. So it's not surprising, but it wasn't Viola's goal. And Paul's goal in Second City was to create a satiric theater that it was, you know, but they didn't, early on at Second City, they had serious scenes that were moving and emotional and relational, you know, that I think that they may still continue with that sometimes, but it really is thought of as comedy now, and things changed over time. Paul sold his share in 1965 because he was politically aware and not, you know, he and my mom, Carol, who was a big part of this, she was a waitress at Second City, and she met him. She was from a progressive tradition as well as from the arts. She had a very progressive era philosophically, like a painting teacher throughout her whole childhood and was really, that was where she came from, the creative arts, but she met Paul and Viola and as she was a waitress at Second City. And by that time, they were really politically, you know, trying to respond to what was happening at the time, which was, you know, the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War and all this stuff. And that was so, it was just changing the face of American culture. And Chicago, as we know, is an incredibly racially divided and city. And they wanted to respond to all of that. And they were like, well, the satire, it isn't, Paul didn't want to entirely change it, what was working for them. So he left, and he and Viola founded the Game Theater in Chicago, which was nearby. And it was like a theater where they were just going to play Viola's games with the audience and the player. Wow. So it was a real communal experience. And then they also had a nursery school in there until the city shut them down for having a nursery school in a park. And they had all the community groups who meet there. Yeah. And it emerged out of playing Neva Boyd's games and then bowling games. And then it was a real, and then all sorts of wonderful stuff happened in that creative space where Paul sort of discovered story theater. We began working in the tales from the oral tradition and adapting them using Spolin's techniques. And you know, without changing any of the language, really beautiful, a beautiful form of theater that took him to Broadway, and it was a TV show in Canada and stuff. So all of that happened after they left Second City, and no one really knows and talks about the Game Theater because it wasn't a huge success. But for, in terms of like Paul's ideal and Viola's ideal of a true community theater, it was, you know, all the local activist groups that met there, the, you know, the church groups for peace and the women for peace, and they were all coming in and creating their banners. And they really, that was always their goal. Paul and Viola. It wasn't comedy. It wasn't money.
Yeah, it wasn't a commercial comedic theater. No. It was a community center that used these theater traditions to help further the social advancement and the community building work.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, were, you know, sometimes people, you know, well, look, why aren't they more famous? It's like, well, because I mean, look at our culture.
Right. Viola's like a hidden figure, though. I mean, I keep, once you know about her, you keep finding her name where someone points to her. I'm trying to remember the name. Was that River Phoenix was in that movie? And I'm forgetting the name of the movie, but they
Stand
they,
by Me.
Yeah, the director used the methods to get the boys to know one another because he knew about that. And you hear people starting theater companies using her book. And it feels like she wasn't known, as so many women are not known, but a lot of people knew that they learned from her. A lot of people knew that the book transformed their acting career or their lives, or they used it in so many ways.
It's had an incredible.
We had another dog. We had a dog moment instead of a phone moment this time.
Yeah, no, I mean, she really is starting to get her due, I think, and she did in her lifetime to some extent. She also got ripped off a lot by people taking what she did and gutting.
Just publishing it in their book and not mentioning where they got it from.
There's a book I found in her archive that was literally every game of hers, but they just changed the name and the wording and published it pre-AI, you know, but it was pre-AI. But and
we don't need AI. We were perfectly good at stealing stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think I think people are coming back to understanding that the roots of the art form of improvisational theater, which is more than just improv, I always like to add too. There's, in, you know, the ensemble theater movement and the devised theater movement all have some relation to the methods that Viola created and also Neva Boyd. You know, we owe them a great debt. These
right.
pioneering women.
Right. And for you, you're teaching her work all the time. You immersed yourself in her work by knowing your grandmother, by being hijacked occasionally by your father to demonstrate acting techniques.
Right.
I mean, just the audience knows Aretha never had she never wanted to be an actor. that wasn't her goal in life. What do you find to be the fertile ground of this work as you bring it out into the world? What's the meaning that you find in it? Just your perspective. What is her work meant to you?
Her work is, I mean, the longer I do it, the more I see how incredibly modern and relevant it is in terms of an understanding of, you know, getting to our own ground of being, as Viola says. Like, when I think about her work, is literally ways to regulate the nervous system to get us into a state of intuition, flow, whatever you want to call it, the zone, right? A regulated nervous system. And her methods are, it's just unbelievable what happens when people play from that state of safety and how free and how beautiful and how few other kind of interventions are needed, which goes back to we are who we are in that state. And it's so healthy and joyful and freeing. And very often people don't want to take the time. They want to go fast, fast, fast. But to me, it's like, nope, let's listen to Viola. If we, in this way, and when you read her, you know, books like Theater Games for the Lone Actor, where she's really going into this, how to side coach ourselves. Like in her work, there's no teacher, there's a side coach, right? And they're just helping bring us back to the present, both calling out of sort of non-judgmental phrases, things like that, and also presenting the game, right? And evaluating what happened afterwards. But we can learn to side coach ourselves through the process. And that is a way to, you know, as Viola says, to be conscious all the time does not stop the flow, right? Mm-hmm. Be conscious without stopping the flow. And it's incredibly forward thinking.
Yeah.
It's also a way to create theater without traumatizing each other. It's a way to all these things that we're asking these questions now. And I'm always like, Viola and Neva Boyd, we need to go. Like when I went to art school, they told me, I had a particularly grumpy teacher who would say grumpy in the best way, he would say, don't reinvent the wheel. You know, your kids are always reinventing the wheel, you know? And I always think with the theater world hasn't really forgotten Viola in the same way that the improv world did, you know, to be fair. And the educational theater world, that goes double, always have understood the value of Viola's work. But that idea, let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's go look and see, because there is some stuff there that can help us through these big questions we're having. Like, how do we create equity in our spaces on a deep physical, real level, not just like a name only level.
Right.
Right. And you've adapted this work to writing, because this isn't just for actors. There's so many ways to use it to just become more who you are. But you've spent quite a bit of time and you teach classes. And so that also helps with writing. I imagine it's liberating for the writer. What would you say?
Yeah, people tell me that. I mean, I got my MFA in creative writing, and I write fiction and some other forms of writing as well. But so I started adapting. I had always been using her techniques sort of in my work, but unconsciously in a way. The who, what, where, the focus.
It's part of who you are. It's probably hard to know that you're.
And it really helped in every direction of creating a scene that had life and, you know, movement and character. And so Yeah, I started adapting her games for writers. But what was really amazing to me was that I thought it was more technical in a way than it turned out to be, which was that it turned out like using the spacewalks and the game, you know, the games we play at the beginning. Lauren, you know that there's always, we always start every workshop with a traditional game that Viola learned from Neva Boyd, because it does something. It gets the group into the same place just like that, brings us into the present together and gets us out of the head and out of, and then a spacewalk, a sort of meditative feeling self with self into a spacewalk. So doing a lot of those things and using some of her methods to enter the present of our writing. There's some other wonderful methods that help a player enter the present of the past that Viola has, but actually with writing were so liberating. And so it was just found and just quicker to get to the source, you know, and the flow where we get past our blocks, you know.
Yeah. And Alan Alda's using it with scientists. And in my class, I knew there was a woman that was taking the class over the summer. She was going to do it with doctors.
Yeah.
It's just something where you don't always need to be in your head, and then you can kind of be present to what is. And I wanted to make sure to ask you, Dawn, you've had experience with this as well. If there's anything you were feeling or thinking about how Viola's work, what her work has meant to you.
Well, it's just such a lovely antidote for, you know, there was a big sort of masculine strain in acting teaching about breaking down the actor so that you can build them back up again. And it was a very sort of authoritative, destructive, and unsafe methodology. And Viola's work is such a necessary and delightful antidote to that. Because one of the things that I often find when I'm working with a director that is very prescriptive and is very controlling of their rehearsal space is that none of the actors can create under those conditions, because you're so afraid of doing something wrong that it stifles all of your impulses. Whereas something like this, where you are in this state of play, in this sort of zone, as you know the current vernacular is, that's when all the juicy stuff comes out. So yeah, I mean, I am so grateful to this kind of methodology, because it can be so healing to, you know, past damage, and also can be a method to approach this work without having to inflict any damage, quite the opposite. Yeah,
I agree. Absolutely.
Right.
Thank you, Viola.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I was just so grateful. I saw the video, the PBS documentary, and I was like, I wish I could study with her. And then I found the Viola Spolin website. I saw you were teaching, and I just knew, and I felt that. And a student of hers that had studied with her from the beginning told me that he feels like her work relives in you, Aretha. So he was just really happy to be taking
that
class.
Oh, that's so kind. Oh, that's Bob Moyer. He's wonderful.
He is wonderful. And so if anybody would like to, I'll definitely ask you if you want to have anything you want to add, but if you'd like to work with Aretha or there's other people teaching her methods, you can go to violaspolin.com. All of the classes that Aretha's teaching is on there. .org. Thank you.
Yeah. Can I mention something about that?
Sure.
Please do.
Yeah. ViolaSpolin.org is the website where you can find my workshops. But I've recently, because I live in Door County, Wisconsin, which is, so I travel to New York, Chicago, LA, and wherever else sort of, you know,
Italy, for the one time,
come find me. But I'm hiring people to teach longer ongoing classes, as they were really meant to be taught in like 10 weeks minimum, 8 weeks kind of minimum, in Chicago, LA, and New York, with really wonderful teachers who've worked with me a long time. And so I'm trying to get the word out about those. So thank you for letting me talk about those workshops.
They look like fun, and they're very affordable. So I was like, I should try to take that class, but I don't know if I have the time, but it would be wonderful.
Yeah, Mike Greenleaf is wonderful in the teaching the Chicago one.
Right. And you teach your writer's class at least once a year, I believe. So if someone heard this and is a writer, that'll be on violasbolton.org as well.
Yep. I teach. I'm still teaching online. Not as much as I was a few years ago, but I will keep online workshops going as long as I can, because we're working with people from around the world and people who are immunocompromised and just people who would not be able to get the workshop otherwise. So to me, and Viola's games translate so beautifully online and really liven up that dead Zoom space.
They really do. I had a wonderful experience with the educators class. Part of the reason I took it is I was really curious to see how you use it online. And you're right, it fits perfectly.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
So did we cover everything? I didn't skip over anything important.
No, thank you so much. It was nice talking to both of you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
I'm really happy you were able to come. The first in the Founding Mother series, Viola and Neva. We got two Founding Mothers for sure. I think there's some cheering we need to do.
I love it.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
Our other show host will be so proud of me that I figured out the control. So I want to thank everybody for joining us today, our Dawn and Aretha Sills, and also for our listeners for coming. Thank you for joining us for this episode, and I'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone. Blessed be.